Okay, welcome back, and I can't resist. I have to run down a little bit more of the list that Clifford sent me of just some of the visitors to his website covering this non-issue of chemtrails. United States military bases by the dozens. United States Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. United States Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota. U.S. Eielson Air Force Base, Alaska. Andrews Air Force Base, proud home of our Air Force. They were there, repeat visits. Headquarters, United States Air Force, the Pentagon, repeat visits. United States Cannon Air Force Base, New Mexico. Skipping down through these. United States Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Prisons, United States Navy, TRADOC, United States Army Training and Doctrine Command, Newsweek Magazine, a token appearance by the mainstream media, United States Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, otherwise known as DARPA, the Massachusetts Medical Society, owner-publisher, New England Journal of Medicine, Office of the Secretary of Defense, the Office of William S. Cohen himself, Headquarters, United States Air Force, the Pentagon, United States Joint Forces Command, Naval Warfare Assessment Station, L.A. County Emergency Operations Center, Commander-in-Chief, United States Pacific Fleet, Headquarters, United States Air Force, the Pentagon again, Defense Logistics Agency, Office of the Assistant Secretary of the Army, Headquarters, U.S. Air Force, the Pentagon again, repeat visits, multiple departments therein, etc., etc., etc. So again, the evidence, and it is evidence, continues to mount that chemtrails are a very real and very formidable issue that are being watched very closely by all sorts of people on the other side of that fence that we call government. Clifford Carnicom is my guest, and we're moving into our third hour tonight. Cliff, you wanted to talk a bit about CDC statistics, which usually are pretty interesting about diseases. We know that about 70% of the complaints that go into the CDC actually stem from what we believe to be aspartame or NutraSweet toxic reactions. But what do you have on chemtrails?
Well, in a fairly brief fashion, this reference source attracted my interest last year in 1999. Because what happens with the CDC is that they monitor deaths. They monitor mortality from a category of illness in the range of pneumonia and flu. And there is a baseline of what they'll call an epidemic. And the number is 6.8%, and again, another number, but numbers are important sometimes. There's a baseline, and what it means is this. Of those people that were admitted to a hospital or on formal note of having this illness, one of these illnesses, 6.8% of them die. If more than 6.8% of them die, it's considered an epidemic. If less, then things are normal. So you have a chart and a graph of what happens over time. And the pattern that caught my attention and became of interest was that during 1999, one noticed that in the majority of the week, the vast majority of the weeks of the year, I don't remember the exact number for last year, I do for this year, the vast majority of the weeks of the year, we were at above epidemic levels for these illnesses. And that caught my attention, and I simply acknowledged it and noted it within my work. This year has been even of much greater interest, because the numbers on this year are this. 33 out of the 35 weeks in which this period is monitored, we were above the epidemic threshold level. 33 out of 35 weeks. In addition to that, if you look at the chart, and this is available through the site or CDC directly, the numbers are absolutely phenomenal, because this is a periodic function is what it is. It's fairly regular and will go up and down amongst the baseline. and you start getting 7-8%, that's considered highly unusual. That's why you have a definition of an epidemic.
Sure.
At the level of 6.8.
Mm-hmm.
This year, that number spiked up to 11.2%. That's a 67% increase on the threshold baseline level of an epidemic. It's actually an incredible number. And there's many interesting aspects to this. Another is that that monitoring period is now over. It's terminated. One would have to ask, if you're seeing such numbers, why would you terminate that monitoring?
Of course. Of course.
Even if you have some formal designation of a program with a defined limit, if the conditions are extraordinary, unusual, you break the rules.
Oh, if anything, you'd increase the monitoring and put more people on it.
Sure.
You're supposed to be the watchdog of the public health and welfare. This is ridiculous.
So these are the numbers that are there, and a further interesting point is that I've noticed it through this year. I didn't really notice this last year. It may have been here, but certainly through this year, there is a new phrase that is introduced into the definition or diagnosis of these illnesses, and the term is flu-like illness.
Flu-like illness. In other words, we don't know what it is.
Many of us have heard this term, and this, if you think, once again, use history. Look at your lives. Were you ever as a kid diagnosed with a flu-like illness? Not that I can recall, and yet this is now a mainstream term that has been incorporated within CDC definitions as well as the general media reporting.
Well, that's another way of saying we don't know.
Right, and now, again, if you, again, are willing to look at the numbers, what happens is, I've heard varying numbers on this, so I've just looked it up myself, and what I'm seeing in their report is that they're saying, of these folks that die, call it the 11.2%, call it the 7%, whatever you want, in that range, of those people that die, only 15% of them were diagnosed with a formal flu and or pneumonia.
85% died of non-identified causes.
It is unknown. In fact, if I can, I'll read this one statement that's here. It says, whether this is in a more general way, it says, whether this increase in the percentage of pneumonia and influenza deaths is due to influenza activity, respiratory illness due to some other pathogen, or reporting changes in the 122 cities mortality reporting system is unknown.
Right.
So it's an important acknowledgement that there is something going on in a significant fashion that we have not adequately characterized.
And that brings up the obvious point that if one person dies from this program that is apparently underway, whatever it is, if one person dies, is there not liability? Is there not culpability? Is the government or whatever agency is involved with this program, whatever it is that agency not responsible? Well, of course. If hundreds, if thousands, if tens of thousands of people over the past couple of years maybe have died from this program, whatever it may be, we have what's called genocide. We have mass extermination of people through a program of some kind. There was talk early on, is it a test? Do we think it's some kind of a laboratory experiment? Others seem to say, upon reflection, no, this appears to be deployment. How do you feel about that, Cliff?
Well, my style, Jeff, is to avoid drawing premature conclusions.
I understand that.
Guess from my work.
I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, that's fine, because it's an important question, and it's fair to ask me, and I'll try to answer it. But my style is to get the information, to gather the information. It's actually folly. It's worthless for me to draw a conclusion before I have sufficient data. I can speculate, but it's not very meaningful. I will say that early in the game, literally within a month or two, there were five scenarios that came out on this in terms of attempted explanation for what's happening.
Yeah.
They came to me instantaneously. They're actually it's a natural evolution. Those five scenarios, which involve things such as testing, such as vaccination or protection, such as culling, which I originally regarded as completely impossible, nevertheless cannot be eliminated, Another one being in environmental mediation of some sort.
Ozone and working on the ozone.
Yeah, these five categories, whatever they are, I have them listed. They haven't changed in the year and a half. I mean, they never did change. They haven't changed yet. And also, an initial impression I had was that none of these scenarios are mutually exclusive of one another. There is nothing to say that it has to be a single agenda, a single purpose.
It could be all of the above.
There is nothing in my book that eliminates, includes, or excludes these. And so my methods are to gather the information, and we as a nation can learn what is true, not speculate. Let us learn what is true. And if I may so say so, the central issue in this whole affair to me is that of informed consent. It's the central issue. I fully acknowledge that there is, within the realm of possibility, that our lives are actually being saved. Until we know what is going on, we simply don't know. We can't make the conclusion. And regardless of what that outcome is, whether I'm being protected or whether I'm being hurt, the central issue remains informed consent.
My guest is Clifford Carnicom. We're going to pause and come right back. Okay, back, and the email keeps rolling in. This is from Jerry Kierkegaard. Thank you, Jerry. Hi, Jeff. Just got in and saw tonight's show topic. Today in Big Bear Lake, California, the sky was clean and blue in the afternoon. Then I looked up and saw what appeared to be KC-10 spraying a heavy chemtrail. As I watched, the spraying was turned off, just like flipping a switch. Today it was really different. The initial spraying seemed heavy and thick, and within, say, 30 minutes, it had spread into huge clouds. By late afternoon, the whole sky was gray. In all my watching, I have never seen them grow so large, so fast, from Jerry. So these emails come in all day long to me, and Cliff gets many more than I do. All right, Cliff, go ahead. There is much to cover, but we might want to talk about what's happened to you personally since you have begun investigating this at some point. There have been issues.
That's true, Jeff, and while I have no desire to call a special attention to myself, as a part of the record, I guess I would say.
Well, this is journalism, so I ask and you tell.
Right. It is still important to take note of those events which occur. I'm still alive and still safe and sound and have no direct threats against my person that I'm aware of, but I think that it can be said with a fair degree of confidence that there has been, since I began the enterprise of presenting this information on the website, there has been a sustained attempt, repeating attempts, to stifle and or thwart my activity and my work. I think that's a fair statement.
I think it's a gross understatement, but we'll let it ride and let our very able and intelligent listening audience take it from there.
One of the things that I have attempted to do, which is important to me personally, besides presenting the information that I'm able to observe myself and or vouch for, is to create a forum, create a place where people can speak freely on this issue. Since it's quite obvious that there is an agenda of constraint at the highest level by the media of this country. And I have created a forum, a message board on the site from its inception to attempt to give people a place to speak. There's been quite an evolution in that board. It has a year and a half of history behind it now.
Yeah, it does.
But we can say that there were repeated and serious attempts to basically shut that board down through common techniques of misinformation, disinformation, outright fraud,
hoaxes, the whole thing, yeah, sure.
And impersonation. Later on this year, there was a very serious stage of hacking, physical hacking into the computer systems that took place.
Mm-hmm.
Four escalating attempts to shut it down. I will simply say I'll do my best to keep that running the best that I can. But one of the things that's interesting is the evolution of the board. And I eventually had to shift over to a board with higher security measures built within it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear to me that there is a very educated, sincere, deeply involved and motivated group of people that have now risen above those attempts to discredit through the use of false methods, have risen above that and seriously are engaged in discussion of this topic. Many of them at professional levels, serious researchers, hard workers. I do what I can. I have to apologize to people that I simply cannot respond to email and keep up with it, basically. And I try to just keep the site running. But a great deal of credit is due to the people that have really put serious thought into their expression and research and organization on that message board. And it stands in a class, in a league by itself, and I'm actually very proud to provide that place and to see us emerge above a lot of the trash, which basically was attempted to be introduced into that aspect of the work.
There was clearly a considerable amount of energy put into some of that trash that I've seen come my way as well. I mean, the people doing those particular works of dishonesty were fairly eloquent.
That's right, and some of it became fairly serious. It did eventually reach criminal levels.
Yeah.
And certainly involved libel against me of a very high order.
Boy, proving net libel and slander is almost impossible.
Right.
It's very hard. Let me shift gears, if I can, before we go to our next break and take people back to the top of your homepage, which, again, for you latecomers, can be achieved by simply clicking on Cliff's name under Guests at the top of my page. EPA deemed negligent. This was a very interesting gambit, an attempt to bring pressure. Tell us about that, Cliff.
It's an interesting story. It involves the whole case of physical materials that are of interest here. And you cut me off if I don't have enough time, but this is where it starts, is with some physical material that was received. In November of 1999, two parties from two separate locations, two separate dates, found material which they regarded as unusual. These two parties, by anything that I know, had no particular awareness of the so-called chemtrail issue.
Okay, let's hold it right there.
Sure.
So we've got two samples from two people not involved with this controversy at all, who saw something strange. We'll trace this story. It's a very interesting one indeed. The responses from government, Secretary of Defense says, no cause for alarm, no problem. The EPA says it's not aware of any chemtrail spraying. You figure it out. Be right back. All right, we are back with Clifford Carnicom and talking about this strange phenomena of chemtrails, and we're gathering more information all the time. Cliff, go ahead. You're, I think, in the middle of something and just getting ready to make a point. Two different individuals, unbeknownst to each other, collected some data, and we're headed toward the EPA with this, so go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. Collected some physical material on the ground, and it's a stated fact by both parties that unusual aircraft activity occurred immediately preceding the collection of these samples. In one of the cases, the material was actually seen coming down, from the top through the sky and landing on the ground. In fact, a photograph was taken of that midair.
Were the aircraft involved behaving in the way that we've been discussing tonight?
That's right. There was what would we say? Delivery of material.
Okay.
And these two individuals apparently inquired, started generating some inquiries about where to go with this stuff, and my name in that process apparently surfaced as a independent researcher, and contact was made between myself and these two parties, and the material was subsequently sent to me. We have to understand that I don't really have any special resources. I have a strong background in the sciences, but I don't have a medical lab in my home. But I had the interest to basically study this material.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's unknowns at that point. No one really knows what they're dealing with, but I took what I would regard as reasonable precautions and simply analyze it. You know, a fact is, if the material is in the sky, then you're also exposed to it regardless without your choice, so at least when you have it, you have some control over how you handle it. So I did study this material, and the characteristics are this. This material is fibrous in nature. It's white, very white, pure white. It's extremely adhesive. It's extremely elastic. And immediately I was drawn to get this material under a microscope. There was no immediate connection that could be made with this material with the normal world that I know. Also understand, on one of these samples, this material had a stretch of this that was close to 50 feet long, 50 feet extended across two lanes of a highway.
That's amazing.
Sacramento area, and it was about a half inch thick. So, you know,
the whole
quite small, but this was not a small isolated fiber, and certainly the one case.
Half an inch thick, 50 feet?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what was seen on the ground.
You know, all right.
One can surmise that whatever system is delivering this may have failed, basically.
May have plugged up, yes.
Yeah, exactly. But my immediate interest was to get this material under a microscope and start looking at it.
All right.
My microscope is not a $3 million microscope, but I do what I can with what I have.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't take that much sometimes to make some serious study, I guess. And I looked at this material under a microscope, and the other characteristic that emerges then is the size of these fibers. They show themselves to be extremely small. And when you took a few of these fibers, what you thought was just a few of fibers, and put them under a scope, immediately you realize you were actually dealing with hundreds, if not thousands, of these fibers in that sample, which by eye just appeared to be a couple.
Wow.
So the size of the fibers became a very dominant, intriguing characteristic immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Visually, if someone was trying to equate it to some type of material that they think is in our common experience, one might say spider webs. And of course, there were many claims made that, oh, this must be spider webs. But the size of the sample that I referred to originally already lends some doubt to that supposition. Just the mass of material that was seen at the site.
Mm-hmm.
My goal then was to make a study of this with the resources I have available. And what that meant was to try to learn what this was. And so what I did was engage in a period of fiber analysis, and I started to learn about fibers. And I compared this material against any and all known fibers or any of those that were claimed that this material might be.
Mm-hmm.
Such as wool, silk, cotton, nylon, synthetic fibers.
Right, natural or synthetics, okay.
Such as spider webs.
Mm-hmm.
Any candidate which was suggested or I could think of,
mm-hmm.
I compared. And it's really quite interesting because the first thing that comes out as being striking and unusual is the size of this fibers. I developed a method of measuring the size of fibers. And to give you some idea of things, human hair is roughly 60 to 80 microns. Again, another number,
mm-hmm.
but numbers are helpful. A hair is 60 to 100 microns. Cotton fibers came out to be about 10 microns, somewhere in here. Mm-hmm. Wool fibers were in the order of 15 to 25 microns. So all of these fibers had a dimension attached to them. Curiously, the spider web that I measured came out to be about 7 microns on it. Also, another distinguishing characteristic of this material, which you did not see until you got under the microscope, was its waviness. At a microscopic level, you could see it was very wavy, which suggested a synthetic nature to it at that point.
Wavy and in a consistent wave pattern,
yeah,
or random?
No, consistent. Mm-hmm. Very, very wavy form, but only visible at a microscopic level.
Okay.
And originally I thought that might be a call for a reason for the adhesiveness, but later on that doesn't really show itself to be the case. And at some point I came up with a measurement for this fiber as being at a micron. It's the best I could do with my equipment. And I came up with a micron. I also, like I say, I'm sort of have a background in measurement, and I know the process of error estimates are very just as important as the measurement itself.
Well said.
And I understood that my readings were probably good within plus or minus a micron, also at most. So we're dealing with something that struck me as most unusual in terms of size. And so I asked myself, well, what is it? What is there that is of this size?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that comes to mind is asbestos. Now, not asbestos in terms of making a match, but in terms of what kind of fibers are this size. And the only one that comes to mind at this stage is asbestos, which is on the order of 2 to 3 microns.
Right.
Well, at this point, you realize that there is a great deal of attention that has been given to asbestos as a environmental and a health threat.
You bet. You bet. Hold on right there, if you would, Clifford. We'll take our last break already. What a program. Clifford Carnicom, my guest. His website, again, is available right through my homepage. Click on his name and go there. Spend some time. You won't be able to just take a quick look. It's quite a sight. Be right back. All right, back with Clifford Carnicom, and we're talking about his investigation into these two samples. Very small items indeed. Asbestos, 2 to 3 microns. Viruses, again, down to 1 micron and below. 0.5 microns to a micron is common viral size. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you, Jeff, and I'll try to speed this up a little bit because I don't want you to be pinched for time here at the end. But at this stage of the investigation, the material was sufficiently unique to me that it seemed appropriate to attempt a formal analysis of that. Now, I don't have a great deal of resources available, so that's a difficulty. And I do want to give a great deal of credit here to another individual by the name of David Peterson in Colorado, Aspen,
mm-hmm.
Colorado, who has done a great deal of work with me and was involved in this particular issue of trying to get this material into a formal analysis.
Okay.
So this material did find itself to a professional lab in the field of aerial environmental monitoring and study, environment engineering. But let me say that when this material was sent to this lab, I continued in my own investigations and got quite involved with a series of chemical analyses, basically to try and learn as much as I could. And as I had learned to measure fibers and make comparisons as to size,
mm-hmm.
I did the same thing in terms of chemical analyses and compared the reactions of this material under numerous different chemical situations to many conventional fibers that are understood and known about.
Mm-hmm.
And it remained sufficiently unique to me such that an answer to the question of what is it is a reasonable question to ask. This material was sent to a lab, and in a week or so, I guess there was an initial word that came back more verbally. Later on was printed on a piece of paper, but it was sort of a verbal statement coming back that we think it's spider webs. And just the statement struck me as a little bit curious because This was a supposedly professional lab, and they were making a statement as to what they think it was. And the truth is that, you know, I have sometimes very strong immediate reactions, and my immediate reaction at that point was, well, I really don't care what you think.
Tell me what it is.
Yeah, I want you to identify it.
Sure.
And so it existed in that state, but at that point it raised my flags a little bit, because I was coming up with my own research. It was clearly showing that it wasn't spider webs. There was no way that it could compare. And so another couple weeks went by, and then there was something printed on paper and delivered, and the claim was made that this material, how was it actually said? I don't know if I can remember the exact word, but basically the conclusion was that this is wool or silk fibers. I had just been through quite a bit of work to try and reach decisions myself as to what we were dealing with, and it was immediately obvious to me upon my work that this certainly was not wool or silk, and that's by size alone, as well as a chemical analysis.
And this is a quality lab we're working with, remember
that.
Right,
yeah. At least by all outward appearances.
Yeah.
And at this stage, it was decided that a face-to-face meeting with this lab was necessary to confront them with conclusions they were making, in contrast to my own independent research.
Yes.
And that was done.
Oh, I'd love to have been there.
Dave and I did visit that lab in person, the owner of the company, and I had six to nine ways, clearly outlined in my work, that proved conclusively, as far as I was concerned, that this material was certainly not wool or silk. And my objective and goal was to, first of all, listen to the individual's rationale for his conclusions. And by the way, this letter was signed by two PhDs. And we went in the room, and I certainly attempted not to be antagonistic in any way, but I had an agenda, and that was delivering my information and getting his response. And that process was started, and the first one was of size. I showed the photographs that clearly demonstrated the size of the fiber under a microscope. I can only say this. I made it through item number two of my list of nine, and the individual stated that our arrangements are now terminated.
Okay, so I can see this playing out on a Hollywood movie screen somewhere.
It is. It certainly is. And that is what happened, is that I never made it to number nine. I made it to number two, and the arrangements were terminated.
Well, you had a reality to confront right then and there, I think.
That's true. That's true. But it was important for me.
You made the effort.
You know, there is something about face-to-face that's very important under certain circumstances. And that was one of them.
Okay. We have about 5 minutes left, so tell us what you do know, what you have found, and then very briefly about the letter.
Right. I'll try to summarize this. So what happened at this stage was, you know, I'm not a person to play games. I mean, I honestly just want to know what this stuff is.
Sure.
If the lab tells me it's spider webs and proves it, then the nation's going to know it's spider webs.
You bet.
But I wanted to know what it was, and, you know, there's not resources to pay a lab to do this, so I make a decision. Dave and I both make a decision. Who is it that has the resources and the authority and the means to properly identify this material? The decision was made that the Environmental Protection Agency of this country has a reasonable obligation to satisfy that request.
Something falling from the sky, unknown? Sure, that's where you go.
So forget the games, forget the middlemen. Let's send it to the people that can answer the question.
That we're paying for.
Right. So that indeed is what was done. This material, along with a letter, was sent by certified mail to Carol M. Browner, Administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. That letter was received and acknowledged. The course of events is that, after roughly a month and a half, a letter was sent back. The letter made no reference whatsoever to the physical material which was sent, which was the primary intent of that letter. And the letter that we sent was directed to an auxiliary agency of the Environmental Protection Agency, which responded with a description of conventional contrail formation. and which has to be regarded as being demeaning and patronizing to the original goal and intent of that letter.
Sure.
And that remained the case for 4 months. We allowed an adequate period for her to take action on this affair. We allowed a period of 4 months. It's actually over that now. The original letter was sent on January 20th of this year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a date on this one. It's around June, somewhere June.
May 30th.
Of this year. Yeah, that's when the letter was written, and I think it was sent the next week in June. And a judgment is made in a public way by myself and Dave Peterson as signed that Carol M. Browner of the Environmental Protection Agency is negligent in her duties to simply identify the material which was given to her in all sincerity. It's another story, but we can also say that during this process, while this letter was in her hand and there was no response, there has been additional information which has been gained about these samples that involves a biological component and components, which raises a whole nother avenue of seriousness and raises the need for a proper identification of this material.
There's an urgency to this issue.
That's
clearly
correct.
All right. What were found by way of components?
Red blood cells and white blood cells and other unidentified cells were found within this material when viewed under a high-quality binocular microscope under very specific conditions involving a type of oil. These blood cells appear to be what you would call desiccated or freeze-dried,
mm-hmm,
and are not visible under normal circumstances, even under a high-quality microscope, without knowing what you were looking for.
Footnote here for all of you listening. The freeze-drying of biological warfare components has been technology that has been around for quite some time now. Real convenient. Go ahead, Clifford.
So that has occurred. That's significant information, you know, that introduces another element into this. And this is the state we are at. I simply think that the American people deserve a full account and explanation and identification of the material which has been sent to her, as well as a formal investigation into the hundreds of thousands of accounts of what has occurred in our skies. And there is a reasonable basis for a formal investigation that has been established.
Absolutely. Congressional investigations, whatever. A lot of people would say, let's get the grand juries at work. They are a sort of a secret weapon that people don't even know they have anymore if you can find a good venue for them to function in. This is an extraordinary program that we've just done, Clifford. I don't even know where to begin to ask people to spend the time to examine each component we've talked about tonight. Listen to the program again, folks. Visit Clifford's website. There are an awful lot of people in this country, Cliff, that owe you and your wife and others a great deal of gratitude and thanks, and let me on their behalf extend that to you as much as I'm able to.
I appreciate that very, very much, Jeff, and I simply have to extend that to what is now the hundreds of thousands of people that are now aware of what is going on, and it is simply the time for us to collectively organize our efforts to get a full accounting and disclosure.
Again, Cliff, thank you. I look forward to our next visit. As things develop, please let me know so I can keep our listeners aware as well.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your show, Jeff. I certainly do appreciate it.
You're welcome, sir, and good night.
Bye-bye.
Clifford Carnicom, and his website again is www.carnicom, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, carnicom.com/contrails.htm. And it's a very serious issue, as you noticed in our last few minutes there, the revelation of blood cells, white and red, unknown cell types, and so forth, within these fibers, potentially, of a desiccated or freeze-dried nature, raises a lot of issues. As he said, many avenues need to be pursued now. We shall continue to endeavor to gather the information and pass along to you that which we think is important. Thanks for all your help in sending us stories as well, and thank you very much for choosing to spend your time here listening in tonight. I'll be back in 21 hours. Have a great night, a good day tomorrow, and take care of yourselves.